You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is the 29th of April 2016 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Today we have a special guest with us as well as our usual hosts, Dennis Wise, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, and Messerschmitt, who will be tying up some of his previous presentations today. And we also have Evalion with us, who's a latest rising star on YouTube with some of her fantastic videos that she's been recently doing, how to identify a Jew, how to identify a feminist, the most anti-Semitic video ever. There's one on the Teletubbies that I really enjoyed. But we're going to talk to her a little bit later on, I think, and probably start with the presentation that Messerschmitt has got for us this week. But I'll just say hello to everyone and check that everyone's fine. How are you doing today, Dennis?
Well, a strange week, like quite a lazy week in many ways. But I've just had this new computer and it takes me quite a while to get my head around, you know, getting all the software back on again and et cetera. So I haven't really done much in the world of videos, but I'm sure next week I can crack on and off we run again.
Well, that's really handy. We've got Evalion with us this week then. And also, I must say, you're actually sounding pretty good, Dennis, on this new computer of yours. So maybe it might have been
everywhere.
Yeah, it might have been a blessing in disguise. How are you today, Messerschmitt?
Hello. It's been a beautiful day here. Not a cloud in sight. And I'm also excited about our special guest today. Really glad she accepted my invitation to join us. And I think this will be interesting for a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. And how are you today, Evalion?
I'm doing great.
That's good to hear.
Thank you.
And we'll talk some more with you after the presentation that Messerschmitt's got for us. I believe it's to do with just tying up loose ends of your previous ones. Is that right, Schmidt?
Yes, that's right. What I have basically for you today is leftovers. I hope it won't be as bad as that might sound. Actually, sometimes leftovers can be quite tasty, and I hope that they will be. I have some notes left from previous presentations that somehow got lost during the show, and I thought this material could be of some interest to some. So here's something from Hans-Ulrich Rudel that gives another impression on what it was like to meet Adolf Hitler in person. He had just been awarded another decoration, and this time it was to be given to him by Hitler in person. The Führer pins the medal on our chests. He talks to us for over an hour about the military situation, past, present, and future plans. He touches on the first winter in Russia and Stalingrad. All of us who were there at the front are amazed at his unerring grasp of detail. He does not blame the German soldier at the front, but sees things exactly as we up there have experienced them. He is full of ideas and plans and absolutely confident. Again and again, he stresses that we must win the victory over Bolshevism, as otherwise the world will be plunged into an appalling chaos from which there is no way out. Therefore, Bolshevism must be smashed by us, even though for the present the Western allies refuse to recognize how disastrous is their policy for themselves and the rest of the world. He radiates a calmness which infects us all. Each of us goes away to his task revitalized. And so, 2 days later, I am back with my wing at Kerch. I take over the command of my old squadron. And then, at another point, he talks about the Western Allies' role in the defeat in the East. Our advance has been halted all along the front. We have seen too clearly how this has happened. First the landing in Sicily, and afterwards the putsch against Mussolini. Each time our best divisions have had to be withdrawn and speedily transferred to other points in Europe. How often we tell one another during these weeks, The Soviets have only their Western allies to thank that they continue to exist as a militarily effective force. So that was what I had left from the presentation on Hans-Ulrich Rudel. But actually, he will be mentioned again, because I had some minutes left on Skorzeny, as I said last time, and I actually built somewhat more on that. So let me get my notes in order.
Now, let me just say there, it's really interesting to hear what people actually had to say that met Hitler and what they wrote in their memoirs about him. And just how important it was, the fight that they were waging against Bolshevism. It's interesting there that he points out that the Allies haven't realized the importance of it yet. And this great darkness that the world will be plunged into, that's what we're experiencing now. The triumph of the Bolsheviks, the triumph of this destruction of all that's good and all that's moral. And we are the ones that are carrying that torch on. We're the ones that are still carrying on this fight against Bolshevism and trying to wake people up to the immorality of everything that's going on around us and who it is that's behind it. It's no good saying that it's elites or it's Zionists or it's lizards or it's the rich people or the 1%. We know who it is. It's Jews, and they've been at war with us ever since, we can remember. And it's only now, thanks to the internet, that people are really beginning to wake up to it. And the reason why they're beginning to wake up to it is because we've managed to take over a large part of the internet, and we've got the best people on our side. We've got the people with real creative genius on our side, like Dennis and like Evalian, making this really top quality propaganda is basically what it is. And Hitler's always been known as a top propagandist. Goebbels was a top propagandist. And we've learned from that. I mean, I'm sure every one of us here has read Mein Kampf and knows the importance of propaganda. And that's what we're doing. That's what this podcast is. That's what Dennis's work is. And that's what Evalian's work is. And it's impressive and it's having a good effect. I just thought I'd say that, Schmidt, but please do continue with the next part of your presentation.
Yes, and I agree with what you just said. But before I continue with the deeds of Skorzeny, I would like to get something out of the way first. I said in a previous episode that there were only anonymous Israeli sources for Skorzeny's alleged involvement with the Mossad. I looked at it again, and it turned out that just last month there was an article in the Jewish newspaper Haaretz, where two Jewish secret agents are claimed as sources for these allegations. I would like to quickly examine the credibility of these two sources. The first one is a man who was born as Abraham Gottfried in Germany, but who later called himself Abraham Ahituf. Aside from the fact that he died in 2009, 7 years before the Haaretz article, and cannot be questioned anymore, I would also like to point out what Jewish-controlled Wikipedia says about him. Ahituf authorized the use of lies in Israeli courts to cover confessions obtained by torture. End quote. So we are supposed to take him as a credible source, the one who authorized lying in courts. Really? And then the other one is a Mossad agent by the name of Rafi Eitan, also known as Rafi the Smelly. And I'm not making this up. That's his nickname, according to, again, Wikipedia. He was the one who was responsible for the Pollard affair, in which the Jew and U.S. citizen Pollard was used to steal top-secret information from the United States of America, the supposed ally of Israel. And again, from Wikipedia, numerous active and retired U.S. officials, including Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, former CIA director George Tenet, multiple former U.S. Secretaries of Defense, a bipartisan group of U.S. congressional leaders, and members of the American intelligence community opposed any form of clemency. They maintained that the damage to the U.S. national security due to Pollard's espionage was far more severe, wide-ranging, and enduring than publicly acknowledged. Though Pollard argued that he only supplied Israel with information critical to its security, opponents pointed out that he had no way of knowing what the Israelis had received through legitimate exchange, and that much of the data he compromised had nothing to do with Israeli security. Pollard revealed aspects of the American intelligence gathering process, the source and methods. He sold numerous closely guarded state secrets, including the National Security Agency's 10-volume manual on how the U.S. gathers its signal intelligence, and disclosed the names of thousands of people who had cooperated with U.S. intelligence agencies. While Benjamin Netanyahu argued that Pollard worked exclusively for Israel, Pollard himself admitted shopping his services successfully in some cases to other countries. I'm sorry if I'm going a bit too far off topic with this, but I would like to point out another example of what the Mossad is and does. In 1990, a former Mossad agent by the name of Viktor Ostrovsky, who was so disgusted with the methods of the Mossad that he resigned from it, wrote a book called By Way of Deception, The Making and Unmaking of a Mossad Officer. In it, he describes, among other examples, how the Mossad knew in advance of the bombing of the U.S. Marines compound in Beirut, which killed hundreds of soldiers. But he did not, the Mossad did not give the U.S. the time and location of the planned bombing, even though they had that information. So in conclusion, I still don't think there are any credible sources for the claims that Skorzeny ever worked for the Mossad. Again, in Skorzeny's autobiography, he gives us his word that he never did take part in any commandos after the war and never would. And the autobiography was written after these alleged cooperations with the Mossad. What we do know is that his war record is impeccable. His behavior was honorable all the way through. Even though he was accused of war crimes by the Allies, they had to acquit him of all charges. And I will get into that a bit more. But if you have some comments or questions on that.
Any comments on that, Dennis, on the Mossad there and their lies and deception, basically?
I think that's the motto, isn't it? You know,
they are what they are.
I mean, I can remember after the Olympic Games in Munich, when one of the Palestinian organizations, with the PLO maybe, I can't remember, on the Black September, and they massacred some Jewish athletes in Munich, and I followed up research on it after, and Israel took every single advantage they could of going out and entering countries illegally and killing and murdering and just breaking all international laws, and got away with murder just on the strength of saying they were looking for retribution. But you know, you overstepped the line. I think there's some killings in France and killings in a couple of other countries in Europe. But no remorse. They had people targeted before the massacres at the Olympic Games, and they took that opportunity to turn people out. So they are what they are, you know. I mean, they've gone into countries and smuggled people back to Israel for trial. Again, blatant laws brought, just carefree. No one ever dares challenge them.
The Jews just think they're above the law. They just think they're above the law all the time. There's cases where they've stolen people's passports, I remember, and assassinated someone, and it was worked out that it was the Mossad that did this. Nothing was done about it. It's murder. If somebody murders someone else it doesn't matter what country it's in, it's murder. And yet if it's the Jews, nothing is said about it. And then you've got these people trying to smear Skorzeny's name. And their own records themselves are really unreliable. And we've got his record, we've got his autobiography, so, you know, we can stick to him and his word because he was a man of honour. Everything that he did in his life was honourable. And honour was a really important thing to him, as we learned from your presentation, Schmidt. Do you want to please continue?
All right. In April 1945, he received the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross for his valiant actions at the Eastern Front, especially his valiant defense of Schwedt, a town at the River Oder, about 80 kilometers to the northeast of Berlin. Himmler gave him the order to build a bridgehead there and hold it for a counteroffensive. A counteroffensive that never came, but he nevertheless held that bridgehead for weeks, and this despite getting very little support and supplies. He had to form sick or recovering soldiers and all kinds of scattered and lost troops into what became known as the Division Schwedt, which he called, not without pride, his European Division. Over time, soldiers from many countries came to join them. There were Norwegians, Danes, Dutch, Belgians, Frenchmen, and Romanians, and even Cossacks. And not just that, there were farmers, dock workers from Hamburg, Luftwaffe ground personnel, German Navy sailors. And he managed to inspire these men to hold the line for weeks against the Soviet enemy, who had a gigantic numerical superiority in every way imaginable. Skorzeny himself estimates that it was 12 to 15 to 1. He would send out scouts to find and acquire anything they could use. They collected all they could from abandoned depots, factories, and a nearby airfield. They used 8.8-centimeter flak cannons as artillery and anti-tank guns. On Skorzeny's orders, they tied them to trucks and moved them to a different location each time after firing a few shells. They put flak cannons on boats on the River Oder and moved them about to give the enemy the impression there was a force much larger than they actually were, and even counterattacked after some the enemy's attempts to break through. And once those had been defeated, they even counterattacked with what little they had. Göring came to visit him and his men. He insisted on being led to the very front line. They had to go on foot for the last part of the distance and threw themselves on the frozen ground each time artillery shells were impacting near them. Once with the front soldiers, Göring handed out schnapps, cigarettes and cigars, handshakes and words of encouragement. As I mentioned before, for his accomplishments at Schwedt, Skorzeny was awarded the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross and congratulated in person by Adolf Hitler. While they were still holding off the Soviets, he was ordered to the Führerhauptquartier in Berlin. Another Waffen-SS commander took over the defense of the bridgehead. He, Skorzeny, was ordered to plan and let his Friedenthal men carry out several special operations at the Western Front. But one night, when Berlin was under terror bombing attack again and 2,000 kilo bombs were impacting ever closer, Skorzeny decided to seek shelter in the great bunker near the Zoological Garden in Berlin. He used the occasion to visit two of his men who were lying there, as the bunker also served as a military hospital, and pay a visit to his friend and comrade, Hans-Ulrich Rudel, who had just lost his lower leg. Hanna Reitsch was also there. On the 30th of April, the High Command of the Wehrmacht ordered him to establish his staff at the Alps Fortress and prepare defenses. He again had to improvise and scrape together men and material for this. But on the morning of the 10th of April, he received the information that Vienna was already under direct threat. Vienna was his hometown, as you perhaps remember. And his mother, his wife, and his daughter were still there. He drove there with his new adjutant and his driver, who had already been with him for the liberation of Mussolini. As he was driving through Vienna, which was already partly under Soviet control, he came to a barricade, which was manned by two old Viennese policemen. They told him, We are the crew of this barricade here. When the Russians show up, we will encircle them and they will have to surrender. Scorsese remarks on the typical Viennese sense of humor. He writes, in Vienna, people always have a sense of humor, even if it is only gallows humor. Later, Scorsese found the house of his mother lying half in ruins. A neighbor was able to reassure him, however, that his mother, along with his wife and daughter, had left Vienna the day before. He went to his home and found it untouched. He quickly grabbed some of the hunting rifles and left his home to its fate. On the 30th of April 1945, back in Berlin, he heard of the death of Adolf Hitler. The city was enclosed by the Russians and in ruins. The last soldiers were still defending the Reichskanzlei, the Reich Chancellery, and among them fighting with particular tenacity a battalion of the French Waffen-SS Division Charlemagne. Scorsese was in shock and didn't know whether to believe it. For a time he thought it was a lie, but then on the next day when he heard the 7th Symphony by Anton Bruckner on the German radio, he knew what had happened. Before his death, Adolf Hitler had designated Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz as his successor as the German head of state. I'm going to give you my translation of what he said and what Scorsese and the German people heard on the radio. I did my best to give you the most accurate rendering of his words that I am capable of. There are certainly available English translation of his speech, but personally, I just don't trust them because I'm quite sure they were not made by objective people after the war. And if I check the available translations word by word for accuracy, then it's almost the same amount of work as translating myself. So I just did it. I tried to find a translation on Meetapedia, but could not even there find one. I probably would have gone with that one if it had existed. I think the people there can be trusted. As with all the other translations I did for these presentations, I really tried to render them as accurately as possible. I don't think I would leave out certain things or twist the meaning if I thought it would be better to do so for PR reasons. Especially in this case, the words of Dönitz, it was quite difficult because he speaks in a solemn, almost poetic way. And that I sometimes found quite hard to translate to English, to render the whole meaning. I hope I can do it justice, but at the same time, I'm afraid I probably can't. Still, here it is. On the first day of May, the Reich broadcaster Hamburg, which by that time, aside from the station in Flensburg, was the only one still working, broadcast the following words to the German people. And this is the radio speaker. It has been reported from the Führer Hauptquartier that our Führer Adolf Hitler this afternoon, at his command post at the Reich Chancellery, fighting against Bolshevism until his last breath, has fallen for Germany. On the 30th of April, the Führer has appointed Grand Admiral Dönitz as his successor. The Grand Admiral and successor to the Führer speaks to the German folk. And now the words of Dönitz. German men and women, soldiers of the German Wehrmacht, our Führer Adolf Hitler has fallen. In deepest mourning and with the greatest respect, the German folk bows its head. At an early stage, he had recognized the terrible danger of Bolshevism and had consecrated his whole being to this struggle. At the end of this, his struggle and his unswerving straight journey through life stands his hero's death in the capital of the German Reich. His life was but a single service to Germany. His efforts in the struggle against the Bolshevik storm flood were dedicated beyond that for Europe and the whole of the cultured world. The Führer has appointed me as his successor. In awareness of the responsibility I assume leadership of the German folk in this fateful hour, my primary assignment is to save German people from the annihilation through the advancing Bolshevist enemy. For this purpose alone, our military struggle continues. Insofar and as long as the achievement of this goal is hindered by the British and the Americans, we shall have to keep defending ourselves against them and continue to fight. The Anglo-Americans are continuing this war no longer for their own peoples, but solely for the spreading of Bolshevism in Europe. What the German folk has accomplished fighting in the struggle of this war and have endured in their homeland is historically without precedent. In the coming time of distress of our folk, I will endeavor to create and provide bearable living conditions as far as this will be in my power. For all this, I need your help. I'm asking for you, for your trust. For your path is also my path. Keep order and discipline in the cities as well as in the countryside. May each and every one of you do their duty at the place or station they are at. For that is the only way we shall be able to temper the sufferings that the coming time will bring to each of us and prevent the breakdown. If we do what is in our power, then the Lord, after so much suffering and sacrifice, will not abandon us.
So very sad, isn't it? Very, very moving. You notice that there's nothing there about Hitler being a madman, which is what they keep trying to tell us today, that Hitler was a madman. That's what's been all over the BBC news today. If he was a madman, why didn't anybody say that at the time? Why is Admiral Dönitz there saying, this noble fight against Bolshevism, and that the Allies in their war, they're just fighting for Bolshevism, basically. That's all that war was about, was making the world safe for communism, wasn't it, really? Dennis, have you got something you'd like to, a comment you'd like to make on that?
Yeah, well, I always remember about Dönitz being a most respectable, officer who, in the German Navy, he led the submarines, and a lot of his tactics were used after by the Americans, and quite an honourable man. And the way the British treated him at the time of the so-called surrender, wouldn't even shake his hand, and just treated him like trash. Whereas opposite, when France fell to Germany, how the French were treated with the utmost respect. After all, war is war, but comes a point where it has to end, either by a victory or just coming to a natural end, and things have to carry on. And Germany never actually looted France as such, treated France with as much respect as they could. Totally opposite to what the British did with Dönitz and the rest of the Germans. But then again, this has always been a Jewish policy.
Oh, yeah, that is the Jews all over, isn't it? It's just destroyers. They're destroyers. They're not creators. Valian, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that before we start to discuss some of your videos?
No, I don't. It's very interesting.
I was going to say,
I've just been listening and relaxing a little bit here.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. I was wondering how it was that you came across nationalism and Hitler. Was it all just through discovering it online, or did one of your friends bring the subject up to you?
It was all through online. It was a process.
But,
it began when I was like 10 years old, and I told this in another interview. There was a Jewish girl at school, and they were discussing the Holocaust, and she was getting all the attention in class. She's like, "Oh, my grandma almost got gassed." And some kids looked at me and said, "Oh, so she's German. She's a Nazi." And I was kind of the outcast of the group, and that made me upset. I went home, and I didn't think Hitler was that bad of a guy. He looked really awesome in the pictures they showed us. So I brought up some facts to them at school, telling them that, Hitler was an artist and he really wasn't that bad. They didn't like that too much.
Yeah, I bet they didn't like it. So do you want to say something there, Dennis?
Yeah, well, I was going to ask, at what age was she enlightened? But she just said that she was 10 years of age, which I think is fantastic. I mean, I checked out her videos. I had actually seen one or two and realized it was her. For that, you know, for a young age of 18, it's remarkable, absolutely remarkable. I'm in awe of the young lady.
I was wondering, have you had any professional lessons at all in video editing or anything like that? Any study in it at school? Or
I took a high school class. That's it.
You've done really well. I didn't really come across nationalism until I was in my 30s. You know, it really annoys me that this information wasn't out there when I was younger, because I think it's very easy to take the wrong path in life. But now this information is there. You know, people can find out the truth at a young age and make sure that they take the right path, which seems to be what you're doing. I mean, one of the videos which I really enjoyed was your Teletubbies one, which I thought was really insightful. I mean, when did you first start to doubt that the Teletubbies were actually any good at all?
It was recent, because I didn't really think about it. It was just a show I watched when I was like a toddler. I didn't think too much about it until I saw a poll post that was pointing out how weird the Teletubbies were. And then I started thinking more into it, and I was just like, holy shit, finding out that it was created by the BBC. And I forgot his name, but the guy was telling everyone that the BBC was evil. And wow.
Yeah.
I just came across a lot of information there. And
yeah, we're brainwashed. In Britain, so from an early age, to say that the BBC is the most neutral transmissions of all, and everybody from a young age to old age used to think at least the BBC was the flagship of honesty, until of course the wonderful Jimmy Savile arrived on the scene and destroyed everything, and everything came out after that. Just what a share of morons they are there.
But you don't think about something as a Teletubbies being propaganda. It seems so innocent. You think of a show like Hannah Montana, or is it Bella and the Bulldogs? Those are Nickelodeon shows that show race mixing and stuff.
I think Simpsons are the same, though, aren't they? I think Family Guy and the Simpsons, I've heard anyway. I don't watch them at all, but I've heard they've got a similar agenda.
Yeah, but Family Guy, you know, has had a lot of hate from the media for being too anti-PC. And I think Family Guy can be very enjoyable if you could pick apart the message and understand it.
Yeah.
After all, it's just satire and comedy and a little bit of their own message there.
To be fair, that's what I like about your videos, because mine are super serious, you know what I mean? But yours have that breath of fresh air with that little bit of humor as well. Love it. Brilliant.
Yeah, I notice a lot of National Socialist videos on YouTube. All these guys are just so angry and serious. And they have a good reason to be, but we need a little more diversity.
It's nice to see, it really is. Nice to see.
Well, I like the videos of how to identify a Jew and how to identify a feminist. I mean, there's definitely a lot of humour in those. They are well put together. I mean, how long does it take you to do your? I mean, I suppose they're about an average of about 8 minutes long. How long does it take you to make one of those videos?
Well, how to identify a Jew only took about 4 hours. How to identify feminist only took about 2 hours, because that was, of course, a lot easier. I had to do a little more reading and making sure that everything I knew about identifying Jews was correct. Just double checking everything. That's what I always do. Because I don't want to assume something then have someone in the comments be like, oh no, you're wrong. This whole video shit. The video that took me the longest was the most anti-Semitic video ever, which took me over 12 hours plus years and years of combined research and hours of reading other things. So I actually have no idea how long that video took entirely, but 12 hours of fact-checking and putting it all together and editing the video. And there's some parts I wasn't sure what picture to put, so I would just Google imaging and searching through all my USB sticks with my pictures and just trying to find the right one.
Yeah, it's hard to find the right ones. I mean, I remember making a video up a while back. It took me forever, and that was just going through one picture after another. Just trying to find the pictures took me a long time. And I thought, well, I'm not going to be any good at this. I'll give that up. It does show, I think, that you've had some training in it. If you're able to get them done in that short an amount of time, you know, it means that it's not quite so labor intensive for a really good effect that you're actually getting from it. Because these videos have reached a lot of people, haven't they? And they've upset people as well, I think. How many of them have you had pulled from YouTube so far?
I've heard a lot of stuff from people enjoying my videos and people saying I red-pilled them. That's really awesome.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you have. Did you have one of your channels, was that pulled down? Was one of them showered? How many?
Yeah, one got shut down, but now I have this one, which is my biggest channel. The other channel that got shut down was only at like 1,000 subscribers. Now I'm at 5,500, so...
I think Dennis has had quite a few of his videos pulled, haven't you, Dennis? I'm not sure how many channels he's been through or how many videos have been pulled down, but they're constantly pulling down Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told. Schmidt, have you got some questions for Evalion that you wanted to ask?
Yes. Earlier in the chat room, you mentioned David Duke as one of your influences. Are there any others you could mention that helped you in your research?
Dr. William Pierce, George Lincoln Rockwell, some just other people that are I've met online and read their articles and stuff. I'd count them as influences, as just a combined effort to increase my knowledge on things.
Yeah, and as Dennis said, your videos are just fun to watch, and I think that will attract a lot of people who would never dream of typing National Socialism into Google or YouTube search engine. So that's great. And what do you think of Donald Trump?
I think that he's the best candidate ever. He's a little shady in some areas. Like he did that speech at AIPAC where he was like, I love Jews. And then he just recently like Caitlyn Jenner into the woman's bathroom in his Trump Tower. So those are little shady things I don't entirely agree with. But I mean, he's the best candidate for the U.S. I think he'll be a great leader.
So long as he keeps Clinton from getting in there, I think that's the most important thing. Now, I mean, some people say, well, he's got his daughter's married a Jew, or he's friendly towards Jews. But you think, well, weigh that up to the good things that he's done and the good things that he's spoken about. And none of the other candidates have said anything good. None of them have spoken up against immigration. None of them have spoken up against Muslims. So the fact that there are a few things about him that aren't good, that's no reason to reject him. I mean, we can't just hold out for somebody who's going to be absolutely perfect. We're not going to get someone who's absolutely perfect. We're not going to get another Adolf Hitler. We've had our Adolf Hitler. If it wasn't for Adolf Hitler, then we wouldn't be having this conversation now. Everything would have been destroyed back then instead of going on its way now. So I think, you know, we've got to support the people that are saying some of the right things and not just reject them because they're not saying all of the right things, if you know what
Look
I mean.
Look at the alternative thing.
Yeah. That's it.
I think there will be another Adolf Hitler, or someone with similar ideals rising to power, someone inspired by him. I think that when that happens, of course, our society would have degenerated to a very sad state if things aren't done at the moment. When we have another Great Depression and people are starving, that is when people will look up to fascism.
Well, that's it. We have to wait until the people get really hungry. That's always been the way, hasn't it? It's not until...
Yeah, people right now are just so pacified with their McDonald's, with their internet, with their video games.
Need to wait until some of that's not there. Go on.
It's, you know, in a capitalist society, getting food and resources is not a problem. Even if you want to sit at home all day, you could get on welfare. You could get on disability.
And I think the problem with the welfare and the disability is that it's all going to these other races. If it was going to our own people, our own people, you know, we strive to do the best that we can. And if we've got everything paid for us, then we don't feel of any use. And we get people, our people, when they're on welfare, they end up going off and committing suicide. But these other races, especially Negroes, are quite happy to sit there on welfare all day long. They think it's great that everything's being done for them. They haven't actually got any desire to better themselves or to contribute to society in any way, just so long as everything's done for them. It's like the Negroes in Africa saying, feed me all the time, you know?
I think the reliance on welfare is also hurting the other races as well, because the Negroes realize, hey, I could get welfare for free. Why do I have to go get a job? Why do I have to work on bettering myself and my race? The natives actually particularly are really bad at this because they're told all their life that their land was stolen and the government owes them reparations and they should just get their reparation money. And the natives here in Canada get a lot of money and they spend it. They're not good at spending it, so the reservations are shit, but they're always spending it on whiskey and shit. And they have this victim mentality that's really holding them back.
No, I can believe that as well, because it's the same over here. You know, people leaving school, they've got no future. You know, the jobs are either low pay or they don't exist at all. The only way of getting a decent wage is probably joining the army or the police and getting in on the system. So I can totally see where she's coming from. It is a kind of mind control. You know, get people so depressed that they lose all the will to for any self-preservation and improving their lives.
Yeah, and you also know now that they are reliant on the government for living, they will never vote for a right-wing party or nationalistic party because they know that they have to vote for the left to give them more money because they're like, how am I going to live? If I'm forced to get a job, I won't be able to live.
Yeah, and that's probably true.
I think that's what a lot of people fear. And I think we need to break that fear, to be honest. But if we have no control in the government, then we can't really do anything about that.
Yeah, well, I noticed a while back that Trudeau won the election out of the blue and, you know, he came from nowhere. I'm just wondering what Canada is, has Canada bettered under Trudeau or not?
Wait, can you repeat that?
Yeah, Trudeau, the Prime Minister, he won the election like he was like an underdog and came from nowhere. He was only young. I was just wondering, since he's been in, has Canada improved any or has things just carried on as normal?
Trudeau didn't came from nowhere. His dad, Pierre Trudeau, was a Prime Minister as well. And he was very respected. A lot of people regard Pierre as the best Prime Minister ever. I personally don't, but a lot of people regard him as that. So I think people were like, oh, he's going to be just like his dad. He's going to fill his dad's shoes and make the country great again. But that's not happening.
No.
I could go into details where Pierre Trudeau fucked things up, but now, Justin Trudeau, he is young. He was an unfamiliar face, but people just knew his name and saw he was attractive. Here in Canada, we don't have a proper right-wing party. We don't have any nationalistic party. The conservatives are like the Democrats in the U.S., pretty much, and the liberals are like just completely communist socialists. I don't know what to describe them as. And then you have the Orange Party. I forgot what it's called. The NDP. I don't know what they stand for. They're always changing their message. They had this one lady running who didn't know what the Holocaust was, and she was making Auschwitz jokes, and I thought that was so funny. She got in a lot of trouble for that, and that fucked over her career.
Yeah, I bet she did. Because that's where Ernst Zundel got his problems, isn't he, in Canada?
Yeah. But people in her generation, my mom is part of that lady's generation, and a lot of them have not heard of the 6 million. My mom did not hear of the 6 million, so it was easy to tell her what Adolf Hitler did. And she was like, oh, yeah, that's great. We need another leader like that.
Yep. And yep.
Well, this programming is quite late.
Those people. What?
I was going to say, this programming with the Holocaust, it's been quite late. It's only been in the last 20 years that people have been taught it at school, and all these films have come out every year. And this figure of 6 million is used all the time. It's just been very recently. People of the older generation aren't aware of it. I mean, they saw the atrocity propaganda after the war, but that was it. It didn't get mentioned again until the 70s. And then it was in the 80s when they really started pushing it. So older people have missed out on seeing that. But I was going to ask you about the political scene there. You say that you haven't really got any right-wing political parties, proper nationalist parties. I mean, that's the same in Britain. But we do have nationalist groups. We've got street activist groups, various groups, ethnic nationalists. So is there anything like that in Canada? Because I know there is... obviously Ernst Sandel has been mentioned. There's somebody else, Dr. James something or other, I'm momentarily forgetting his surname, but he's openly National Socialist, and I think he was standing for Parliament at some point. Have you heard of him? Do you know who I'm referring to?
I'm not familiar with any of the names or groups that might be active. I definitely haven't seen their propaganda or them protesting or being loud, so they're not that active. At least not in southern Ontario. I think that most of the nationalists would live on the west coast of Canada, because that is just people are more nationalistic there. The east coast tends to be more left wing, and I'm kind of in the middle there. So,
and if you're making these videos,
my area is the majority non-white, so I don't think they are going to be the ones that are doing that kind of stuff.
But if you've got a majority non-white area, then there's probably a lot of whites there that are feeling similar to you. And if you're becoming a personality, you're becoming known on the internet, you know, you can speak, you can articulate what it is you want to say well, and you've got the information there, then, you know, surely it would be good if there was somewhere that you could, you know, a group that you could join that could make use of your talents, you know, that you could.
I am looking.
I think there is a thing. I think Justice for Germans has one, don't they?
I am looking around for a group. If I see a group that's worthy of my contribution, that is actually going somewhere, I definitely would be interested in joining them. And if anyone's listening, know of any group like that, that I could look into, talk to the founders and stuff, that would be really neat. I have seen people who share my ideals here in Southern Ontario, but people are just so afraid to speak out against stuff. And I understand, because if I wear a shirt that says, I don't like niggers, I'm going to get a lot of hate. And I'm a 90-pound girl who's 5'2", and I could get kidnapped and beat up really easy.
Have you had any negative comeback from your videos at all? Have you had any negative feedback from people or in personal life for your videos?
Not in personal life. Well, there was this one time recently, I mentioned in my rambling video, I was walking on the bridge, right? I was walking my bike uphill because it's an uphill. I don't like biking uphill sometimes if it's too steep, because I guess I'm not that strong. My bike is just old. But anyways, I was walking, right? And this nigger comes up to me and he pushes me. And he almost pushed me off the freaking bridge. And I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, nigger? Want to try that again? And he just smiled at me and ran away. Like, I don't know if he recognized me from YouTube. But that was just the one recent occurrence that he might have recognized me from YouTube.
Would you ever consider actually going into politics if you had the chance, like running for office?
I don't know. I've considered it. I don't know if I'd be good. I'm more of a propagandist like Joseph Goebbels.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. I think Mexico, Canada, with a NAFTA agreement, you'll lose all nationality, all sovereignty anyway, I think, and be just one big nation full of Mexicans and whatever.
They're going to make the United States of North America or something and just merge everyone together. I don't know.
You say it's very multicultural where you are. Is a lot of that been newcomers, or is that because you've got a lot of Indians there, the Aborigines that you were saying are pretty lazy?
Well, not my particular area. I don't have the Aborigines in this area. I'm not in northern Ontario. You'll see more of them up there. But most of the non-whites happen to be newcomers, at least people who moved here in the last 5 years or so. Whites have already got up and left for the suburbs in northern Ontario. Non-whites are just flowing in. It sucks. The job market here is so bad because of that, and it left me in a really itchy financial state. But now I have videos of my face out there, I do wonder if I'll ever get an employer that will recognize me from YouTube, being like, oh my god, you're the fastest, get the hell out of here, I'm gonna hire you.
That is a problem with putting your face out there.
I love how you support that. People like Ivalion and everybody subscribe to our channel right away.
People are risking. I have a lot of people saying I'm just doing this for money. But if I was just doing this for money, wouldn't I make videos that, like, gain money? Like, feminist videos. I would be, like, making videos, just vlogging, gaming videos, just producing mainstream content.
Well, that's
I think
just
I'm funny enough to make skits and stuff, but...
Well, that's it. You know, if you're going to put your name and your face out there, I think you're showing a certain degree of courage, and people should support you for that. We have a real problem with this. People put their face up there, people put their name up there, and then certain portions of the nationalist movement attack them and make all these accusations against them. And they're not nearly always anonymous people that are doing this. You know, have you had any attacks from anonymous?
You notice it's anonymous. Yes, you notice it's anonymous people. This is a shill tactic. This is probably the most widely used shill tactic. And I'm very certain that this is a shill tactic because they want to make people who watch nationalists who are paranoid, who watch these people, re-question them. And since these people are already so used to questioning the media, they're like, oh, this person must be a shill too. And the slow-mo is sitting behind the TV being, the screen being like, yes, they're all shills, guys, don't believe them. The 6 million was true. But sometimes they don't even say that. They just go on making their lives. There's this one dude who makes videos about me. He doesn't show his face or his voice, of course, because he probably sounds very Jewy. But he's accusing me of being a literal wizard. Don't lie. He thinks I'm a wizard.
Harry Potter style.
He thinks I'm doing magic and I destroyed his toilet with my magic.
I couldn't
believe this guy. He thinks that I mass reported his videos because he has 5 downvotes out of like 5, like it's 50% up and down, even though he only got like 100 views. I couldn't believe that. But there are people who support him and were like, yeah, Shadeku is a wizard, holy shit. I can't watch her anymore.
Right.
So, unless they were being sarcastic, and I don't know. I know those people weren't subbed to me, so...
When did you start to notice that feminism wasn't actually doing women any good at all, and it was anti-female? When did you start to notice that?
That was in high school, I believe. Yeah. I started getting interested in the feminist movement, and I was starting to think, yeah, maybe equality is good. It is. And then I started seeing how people acted when they were... in the feminist ideology. And then I kind of came to the conclusion that these people aren't really feminists. They are just young and naive and being stupid. And I didn't consider myself a feminist, but I was interested in the ideology. And then I found people on YouTube and more YouTube for feminists. I'm like, holy shit, are all these women retarded? And then I looked in the women that were the most prominent members, and I found they're all Jewish women. And then I thought really hard on it, and I'm like, what would be the goal of feminists if Jewish people are perpetuating it into society? And what is this the cause of the lower birth rates? And I believe it is. It's a really toxic ideology. You know, we're told in school that women are incredibly equal to men, and I remember my female teachers yelling at boys for saying a misogynist thing, and in gym class too, I remember my teacher was like, girls and boys are equal, so that's why we shouldn't separate the genders here. Well, that was in grade 8, not high school. High school is gender segregated, of course.
So they're really trying to push it on you at school then.
There was forms of propaganda there. And I noticed kids that did identify as feminists, but you know, I was the outcast of the group. I never got involved with those kids or befriended them, and I'm glad I didn't. Maybe I'd be just like them if I did.
Well, I think it's quite good that you didn't go along with the crowd. I mean, the temptation is always to go along with the herd, and which is usually, should be a good thing, because the herd should be doing what's right. But if you've got other people that are controlling your country, you've got a foreign group that's controlling things, and the herd is going to be doing the wrong thing. So it's the ones that stand out from the herd that are a little bit left out from things, I think, that are the ones that think a bit more and that are more likely to come to the truth, like you have. And I think your insights on feminism are pretty good, especially how to notice a feminist. The video you did showing the blue hair and even one with the blue armpits and the big glasses, I think that's quite spot on. Is exactly what the feminists are like. You say you've had a few around you, but I think you've done quite well in deconstructing feminism online on YouTube. Have you had any run-ins with these YouTube feminists at all?
Not really. There's this one girl I did. She was actually, I did not know she was 11 years old. I thought she was 14, but I did a reply video to her feminist video, and she was just talking, saying the typical feminist stuff. It was called problematic things, and she was British, and she was just spitting out the typical brainwashing shit. And I actually got to talk to her, and I just encouraged her to look more into things and think more about what you're saying, because not everyone on Tumblr is right, even though they're older women you might look up to.
Can I just butt in here?
Yeah.
I saw that original video of the woman kicking off with that young lad, which you used in that video. I don't know if Finn remembers it.
Yeah.
This woman's just kicking everything in his face all the time. And on the original video, I wrote, I stand by this saying, I've stood by it all my life, and I'll stand by it till I die. Act like a man, treat like a man. That's all I've got to say to feminists.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's quite right. Quite right too. I think they've always got to have it two different ways, haven't they? They want to be treated like a man, apart from when they're actually there in court, and then they want to be treated like a woman, and they don't want to be sent to the prison. It's just, you've always got to try and have it both ways. And we're coming up near the end of the podcast now. Evalion, do you want to let people know where they can find your work, where they can subscribe to your work?
Yeah, you can look up Evalion on YouTube, Evalion, and you can find my videos on there. I talk about Jews, feminists, anti-political correctness, things, anti-Islam, and all the good stuff.
And you've got a Twitter as well, I think, just recently, haven't you?
Yes, Evalion88 is my Twitter name. But yeah, you can find a link to my Twitter on my YouTube.
Now, I definitely recommend checking those videos out. They are really funny. I expect most of our listeners already have. And that's why we have you on here. And I'm sure they'd be interested to hear what you're like, find out more about you. Dennis, do you want to let people know where they can find your work?
Yeah, I'd just like to thank the NSA for cocking up this program this week once again. I think they must know the content, what's coming. But they can join me on YouTube, Dennis Wise channel. New documentary Communism by the Back Door. I'll be working on it again next week. And of course, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. He's getting some really good reviews actually since he's gone back up on YouTube again. It looks like people have in this length of time, that's passed, it's been banned, have seen the light. So yeah, you can see that on the website, The Greatest Story Never Told, or like I say, back up on YouTube.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on, Evalion. Thank you again, Dennis, and thank you, Messerschmitt. And we'll be back next week with another Truthful Out Radio at the same time, same place.